on The Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
A lot of my listeners grew up with vinyl, and we remember distinctly when CDs came along. And perhaps you might be old enough to remember 45s and maybe even 78s. And if you're like me and kind of always wondered, why did they choose 78 and 45 and 33 and these different speeds? And where did these things come from anyway? I have inherited from one of my grandmothers an actual Edison phonograph, so to speak, the cylinder type. It still looks cool on a shelf. And I knew it was old, but I had to admit, I didn't really know very much about it, other than the fact that it had a wax cylinder that went on it and a stylus that go down and hit the wax and play music or talk or whatever. Even though I've been in the radio business a very, very long time, I never really thought much about the origin of any of that. That's where Jonathan Scott stepped in and said, you need to know these things. His new book is Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tinfoil to Vinyl. It's from Bloomsbury Sigma. Jonathan is a music journalist who's been collecting vinyl since he was 7 years old. He's covered weird, rare, and collectible records for Record Collector magazine and written about everyone from Nirvana to the Pogues to the Venga Boys. His first book, The Vinyl Frontier, told the story of NASA's Voyager Golden Record. I remember that, and I think that's a fascinating sort of thing that got him talking about this. So I'm really delighted that he made time to be with us. Jonathan, thank you for putting up with all the interesting hoops we had to jump through to get going with Zoom. And thank you so much for a copy of the book and a chance to talk about it.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really grateful for you having me on. I'm actually not in London. I'm in a small van in the middle of deepest, darkest Cornwall in the west of England because we're visiting family. And this is the only quiet place I can find because there are a lot of children about.
Oh, bless your heart. Be sure to thank your family and say that I'm really not a bad fella after all, even though I'm interrupting your family get-together, your holiday. Cornwall, what a fascinating place. How did you get interested in the Wayback Machine version of how things started getting recorded? Because it goes further back than I thought. I tended to think of, it must have developed sometime around the time Edison started making patents for it, but didn't really know who else was working on it, what other countries were involved in working on it, and what came from that point forward. So you want to take us back to kind of the earliest days of people who were trying to figure out a way to record voices the way that they were recording images with cameras.
You're right. I didn't realize until I started researching the book quite how early it went. But really, in a sense, the starting point is sort of 1850s. In Paris, where this amazing guy called, quite a long name, but Edwin Leon Scott de Martinville, he was a bookseller and printer by trade, but he became slightly obsessed with the idea of making a version of a photograph, but for sound. But what he created was called a phonotograph, and that was a device for recording airborne sounds, but the key thing about it is that it was never designed to play them back. It was just a device for studying how sound waves, react with the physical environment. And it was it recorded sound by using a boar's bristle. You spoke into a diaphragm and the boar's bristle vibrated and recorded sound waves on sort of lamp blacked paper, okay, making little waves. And he felt that if you could study them, you could figure out a way to sort of read sound direct from just looking at the sound waves, which you couldn't, of course, but it was still, that was the sort of beginning of people realizing, oh, wow, we can record sound. But then forward wind to the 1870s, and obviously a key invention was 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, which was obviously a mind-blowing, world-changing piece of technology.
Right.
And Thomas Edison was in Menlo Park, New Jersey, and he was working on a new version of a telephone. He wanted to bring out his own telephone, a non-infringing telephone.
Right.
And that was that's where the first time someone actually recorded and played back airborne sounds, which was the key. That de Martinville in Paris in the 1850s never played back his sounds. He just recorded them.
Interesting to think that there would be any benefit in just recording it, but I guess this is when the science is extremely new, right? So they didn't.
Exactly. I think the thing was, it was a new device, a device that could record sound. And there had been devices for analyzing sound. There had been all kinds of things. You know, there was when tuning forks were first invented, right. there was the co-sounding experiment, and that was an easy experiment. You sound one tuning fork, and it makes another tuning fork vibrate, and that proves that sound waves are having a physical effect on the environment around them, which by itself is just an amazing thing. But yeah, I know what you mean. You sort of think, what was the point in recording sound waves just to print them? But I think you've got to remember, he was a printer. Now, printing back in those days was an incredibly labor-intensive thing to do. So I think he just became besotted with the idea that, wow, if we can learn to read these little squiggly lines I'm creating, we can do away with all this printing business and just sort of record our speech, you know, straight into, you know, cutting out all the difficult stuff.
Right, but cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
Now, the early on, the recordings have to do with spoken word. But it takes a while for them to figure out, because it's complicated, right? What you talk about in the book is some kind of cone that you had to speak into, and what really surprised me is how many different kinds of combinations of bizarre things Edison and all the other inventors came up with in order to record something and still have it in order to play it back.
Exactly. That was the key, because the first phonograph, the famous first phonograph from 1877, used tin foil wrapped around a cylinder with grooves already built into the cylinder, and that could only it worked, but it did. You couldn't play back the sound more than a couple of times, and obviously removing the tin foil would destroy your recording. So that was the first wave, and then there's basically a hiatus of about 10 years when no one was doing much with phonographs, apart, as in they weren't selling that much. But behind the scenes, people like Edison and another team in Washington, D.C., led by Alexander Graham Bell, did a whole load of experiments trying out all kinds of weird, strange ways of recording sound and playing it back. And actually, it was the Alexander Graham Bell team in Washington, D.C. did some of these. They made some of the first, earliest surviving disc-shaped records. They made records out of glass. They made them out of metal, card. They tried recording with light, with magnetism. You know, they just tried all these strange ways of recording. And then eventually the first sort of commercially successful phonographs came out, which was, as you said earlier in your introduction, were cylinder-shaped records made of a sort of wax. And those were the first ones that, you know, the industry began to take off, because it was a more reliable format.
It was interesting to me to learn that something I had known about Edison is that he was extremely pragmatic about things. If it was going to make money, he would pursue it. If he got the idea that it was just sort of a gimmick and he saw no real way to turn it into cash, he set it aside. And that's kind of what he did after filing the patents for inventing the phonograph. He figured, well, this will be interesting. We can use it for basically a dictaphone or something. But I can't imagine why you would want to listen to music or anything like that. Plus the fact that it was complicated to do with the cone and all of that. So he just sort of sat on it for a while until somebody else got busy. And he suddenly realized, if they're going to make money off it, then by golly, there's bound to be one of my patents that they're using, and we're going to figure this out.
Exactly. There's this sort of complicated period where you're exactly right. He kind of just abandoned it for a while because he was more profitably engaged with inventing light bulbs, you know, and things like that. There was loads of places where he could make money, and the phonograph was just not completely forgotten, but certainly put to one side. But when competitors started coming up with their own phonographs, he went sort of, wait on a minute, this is mine. And he sort of came back into the, you know, and that was the, it was a great, it was a really exciting time. As in, looking back, it was a really exciting time for sort of sound historians, because there were all these competing patents, which actually, you know, in some ways is very boring, but it's also very interesting because it's fascinating to see how they all tried to figure out ways to get around, you know, infringing other people. And that led to loads of new inventions and making, ultimately making the groove, it made it work better.
some point in the 1890s, they different companies and different inventors and so forth began figuring out ways to sell this stuff. And one of the things that you talked about here, the whole idea of this cracked me up, that John Philip Sousa decided he was going to record marches. It was pretty complicated to record, and every time, if you wanted another copy of something, so if you're going to sell them commercially, you have to cut another copy. They didn't know yet how to make copies of the original. They just made more originals. So if you were going to sell 50 copies, say, of The Stars and Stripes Forever by John Philip Sousa and friends, first of all, it was a pretty complicated process to go through to get a handful of musicians into a very tiny area and them moving back and forth and bumping into each other while they're trying to record, which the vision that I have of this has just got to be almost like Keystone Cops. And, boys, trumpets up in the front. But they'd have to record yet another copy if they wanted to sell 50 copies. They had to record it 50 times.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a crazy idea, isn't it? But what they did is that getting a whole brass band into a room was quite a troublesome thing. They would rig up a sort of like wall, a banked wall of 10 recording machines, so that they could create 10 recordings in one go. I mean, it's such an interesting part of the birth of the music industry, which, as you say, is about the 1890s, is such a weird and interesting place to research, because it's fascinating to think the sort of limited frequency range of the technology just meant that certain instruments just didn't work very well. They just didn't work. But brass band music was the sort of, the Beatles of its day. It yes. sold a lot. It was popular. And that sort of loud bum, 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 bum translated well because they're just recording into horns. There's no microphones here. Right. Any tone or volume controls, if you want it to be louder, you get closer to the horn or you shout louder. That's all there was. And actually, when you keep that in mind, and especially, I mean, the early 1890s, some of the sounds that have survived are, you can tell it's an early on, but by the later 1890s, recording engineers were getting better and better at their job. And it's incredible when you think that there's no electricity, no microphones involved, just how good some of the sounds are.
Now, that was another thing about your book. Oh, in case you're just joining us late, we're talking to Jonathan Scott, who is the author of Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tinfoil to Vinyl. It's from Bloomsbury Sigma. His previous book was The Vinyl Frontier, the story of NASA's Voyager Golden Record, which we sent out into the cosmos with no way to play it back. Just figuring, well, if they're that smart, they can figure out how to play it. And
they can build their own record player.
That's right. If they're that darn advanced, let them bring the record player. When one of the things that I was fascinated with, this book is just so full of information that I'd never read anywhere else. So I really enjoyed it. You said that there are actually modern technicians who have digitized some of these really old recordings, and that there are websites where you can go visit and actually hear some of these very early attempts at recording plays or songs or folk songs or poets and so forth. And I find that absolutely amazing that they've been able to figure out, because the stuff that they were doing it with, it's like stone axes.
yeah, I agree. No, it's fascinating. I mean, this is the thing. I felt I'm really enthused about this. I mean, two things that I would recommend any of your listeners do is, one of them, go to firstsounds.org, firstsounds.org. And that's a website led by a number of American scientists and academics who have digitized some of the very early recordings, including those phonautographs made in Paris in 1860, which is staggering to listen to and quite, raises the hairs on the back of my neck. It's just amazing. But another thing you can listen to, so another example, is the Cylinder Audio Archive. That's run by the University of California, and it's free. And it's got downloadable versions of thousands. I mean, I think it's more than 10,000 phonograph cylinders from about the 1890s to about the mid-20s, I think. Wow. And just some of the recordings you can listen to are so strange. They're so interesting. And there are so many of them as well. I mean, you can just get lost. It's such a time vampire. You know, you can kind of think, imagine. Oh, that sounds interesting. And then you're there 2 hours later still listening.
At one point in my interesting life, I taught myself how to tune pianos because I had a music store and I wasn't selling anything. So I thought, well, I've got to figure out some way to bring some money in. So I bought the tools and taught myself how to tune pianos. And first, mostly what I was doing was tuning pianos that had been player pianos. So they had a huge soundboard and a big open area where the mechanism used to go. But there were one or two of those that actually still had the mechanism and had the piano rolls. And I was astonished to find that there were things like George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue as played by George Gershwin on a piano roll. In your book, you also talk about an engineer named Paul Whitman, the American band leader, who cut the first version of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, New York, 10th of July of June, 1924, with Gershwin on piano, and 25 musicians crowded into a, as he says, a tiny, dusky room, barren, crowded, and uncomfortable. I can only imagine. Some of them were on ladders and things like that in order to...
Yeah, that's right, on little raised stages, right? Yeah.
To step up in front.
Yeah. I mean, this was the thing, and he sort of described how, a couple of the, I don't know, a couple of the trombone players would sort of have to jump up for their bit and then, get out of the way quick while the other one has a solo. You know, they had to be real athletes. Yeah.
Now, the 78s, I must admit that the very first records that I ever saw that were old were 78s. And I assumed that they ran at 78 revolution per minute, but I had no idea why that was that they were spinning at that speed. I did know that albums, because they still had albums when I started in radio, were at 33 and a third, and that 45s were 45. And I figured that had to do with the size of the disc, but also how much information you could put on the disc. The 78s, this really had to do with the technology that was developed to spin at a certain speed that seemed to be the optimal speed for the clarity of sound, but also playing things in tune and so forth. And I never knew that before, and I learned that in reading your book, too.
Yeah, it was the shellac era was like, the 78 era lasted. The first record started in the 1890s, but it took off in the 1900s and then lasted till right into the 1940s and beyond, because after vinyl came along, 78s for quite a long time coexisted with vinyl. But yeah, it was all to do with basically sound engineers through, trial and error, had figured out that around a 12-inch or 10-inch disc, it sounded at its best. It was optimal at around 80 revolutions per minute. And it just happened to be that the standard motor and the standard cog size, the closest you could get with those just ordinary parts that were available, was about 78 RPM. And that's just where the speed came from, through trial and error and what they had to hand.
And the shellac records that were still being used beginning of the Second World War, they came from the secretions of an insect.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, again, that's partly what... So the insect came from India. And this was back in a time when Britain still, controlled much of India's economy, right, including that. And then during, it was a sort of build up to the war. And during the war, there was a huge, there was suddenly everyone was running out. There were just problems with supply and demand, which is sort of why it led more companies to try harder to try and find alternative mediums to make records out of. And the thing is, so 78s, they've got a bad reputation for, sounding scratchy and terrible. And obviously they can do, and they don't sound as good as vinyl, but I would also urge people to sort of give 78s a chance, because 78s are still beautiful objects. They still, and when, if they're played with a fresh needle, because this is the thing, back in the 78 era, you kind of were supposed to change your needle every time you play. It wasn't like vinyl where you use the needle and it goes on and on for ages. You had to change it for every play. So quite often, if someone digs out an old 78 who's maybe not used to it and puts it on an old record player with an old, 78 needle, it's going to sound bad because that needle's probably been used loads of times. But honestly, a really clean, lovely 78 with a really clean needle sounds pretty fantastic. It just obviously still doesn't sound quite as good as vinyl.
Right.
But, you know.
But it, yeah, but it's still worth listening to. I mean, you can find, I have found things at Salvation Army and places like that that sell old stuff. I found a original cast recording of Oklahoma in 78 in a deluxe case. Yeah, and so it's really neat. Now, sure, I have many soundtracks of Oklahoma in vinyl and in CD because it's the show that just keeps going and going, and every time they cut another soundtrack album. But to think that you can play this, and these are the people that were doing it when it was brand new on Broadway and a brand new idea, is really extraordinary. And the only way you would get that on vinyl would be if they took the 78s and made a recording of them from the 78 and then burned it to vinyl or burned it to digitalize.
Well, exactly. And that recording of Oklahoma, I know the one you're talking about. I'm quite jealous because I'd quite like those original 78s, because a couple of interesting things about that. First of all, some listeners may not realize, like, that's where the word album kind of comes from, because back in those days, 78s, you know, just didn't have that much. They didn't last very long per side. It was only a few minutes. So an album, if they wanted a whole load of songs, was, you know, they'd have to have 3, 4, 5 discs, would be put together in sort of canvas bound albums. And that's kind of where the word comes from. Oh. But also just Oklahoma, fantastic musical. And those musicals, South Pacific and Oklahoma, were really part of the one of the biggest things that drove people to buy vinyl, particularly South Pacific, because those were so popular, and these original show recordings really captured people's imagination. And having a single disc with all the hits from South Pacific or Oklahoma, just that, more than almost anything else, persuaded people, okay, I need to get the new tech, the new vinyl, the new stylus, the new player, because it just has all this amazing music on one disc. Wow, this is so exciting.
Yeah. I remember reading that the number one album on the top 100 albums, which was a Billboard thing that they started these things in Billboard decades ago, but in 1950, the number one selling album was not the Ames Brothers or Frank Sinatra or anything like that. It was the soundtrack for South Pacific. It's easy for us to forget these days that 60 or 70 years ago, the new tunes that everybody loved came off Broadway or came off the West End.
And I think the thing is, because it's not, obviously people still love those recordings. It's quite obvious that both you and I do. start. But, you know, people still love those recordings, but they're not perhaps as fashionable amongst certain music writers, perhaps.
Yeah.
So I think they sometimes, it's not like they get written out of history. It's just that it's just worth remembering just how important they were in terms of popular music, you know, in the generation before, I suppose, before the Beatles and whatnot. You know, everyone loved those musicals.
Yeah.
And everyone wanted copies of them.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but the Beatles' first album had them recording Till There Was You from The Music Man, which doesn't sound like the kind of song that you normally think of as a Beatles song, but they do a lovely job with it. It's a great song.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Now I know our time is running short, and we could talk for a long time, obviously, but one of the things that I found really interesting is that when the 45 was kind of developed as an inexpensive way to get money from a new concept, and that is of teenagers. Because prior, really, to the Great Depression, there were two types of people. There were children and adults. And teenagers were, that wasn't considered to be a separate entity of humanity. But after World War II, there's a growing feeling that here's another market for selling things, right? And the 1960s, right?
Yes, you're right. Basically, albums didn't really exist in the modern sense until the mid-60s, because albums just tended to be a band or a musician's singles with perhaps a few B-sides thrown in. You know, it wasn't until the sort of mid-60s, and again through the Beatles and other bands like them, that the album as a, you know, as a definite sort of a mark of... I mean, this is one of the most fascinating things about formats, is the way that formats have helped shape music. Do you know what I mean? As in, so Going right back to the beginning, Cylinders helped popularise the short 3-minute song because there was only 3 minutes of sound. That's all they had. And albums with only about 20 minutes per side popularised what we think of as an album. You know, that's standard unit nowadays of currency for a band or a musician. Their statement is an album. Obviously, they can get so much longer nowadays, but the album of about 45 minutes in length was where you set out your stall, you showed just what you can do. Whereas, I mean, still, the single, as you say, there's something so magical about the 45, 7-inch single, the sort of throwaway nature of it, the way you've got to pack all your, you know, just one brilliant song onto one disc and try and, you know, sell it to teenagers. I mean, I've got collections of 12-inch and 7-inch records, but there's something so special about 7-inch records. Yeah. I think they're absolutely delightful things.
Jonathan, we could talk and talk and talk. Obviously, this is a passion that we both share about records, and I've enjoyed this very much. Is there anything that you were hoping that I was going to ask you and I never got around to it?
I don't think so. The only thing I would add is, just because we were just on talking about 45s, is just so the first 7-inches came out in, I've suddenly forgotten the year, but it's the 1940s, late 1940s, that the first vinyl 12-inch came out, and right. the 7-inches appeared the following year. And the very first one to be pressed was in yellow vinyl, and it was Pee Wee the Piccolo. And it's because when RCA first launched their 7-inch records, they color-coded the different genres. So country music, for example, was on green vinyl, and music for kids, juvenile music, was on red vinyl, and there was red and blue. And it's just, I think that's an interesting thing, because most people think of color discs as a more recent thing. But in fact, it was right back at the beginning.
I will admit that I have some little tiny records from little plastic 45s, basically, from the mid-1950s, when I was just a wee lad. They are color, and they're yellow. And I always wondered why they were yellow. So that's what it is. That was to designate, this is a kid's record. So if you're a parent and you're buying stuff for your kids, you say, those are green or red or orange or whatever, but the yellows, those I know are safe. You know, those are kid-friendly, kid-friendly records there. That's amazing. Jonathan, thank you so much. Your book is fascinating, and the information that you contain in it, it's obvious this is a real work of love to have done this kind of in-depth research of so many things about the recording business from the early days and toward the current time that you have found out and put into this very readable book. I'm guessing people can find it at their favorite bookstore and online, all over the place.
Yeah. In your usual places. And I just want to say thank you so, so much for having me on. It's really fun to talk to you.
It's been a great joy for me, too. And when you write your next book, let's do this again. We might even have time to talk a little about that gold record that got shipped out into space.
Oh, yeah. Anytime you want to talk about that, that's a favorite subject of mine, definitely.
All right. Excellent. Jonathan Scott, our guest today, he's the author of Into the Groove, the story of sound from tinfoil to vinyl, from Bloomsbury Sigma, available online or in your favorite bookstore in various countries. And so thank you again so very much, Jonathan, for being with us today on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Dockerby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.